The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Vision News. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you the Blind Post guidelines for the July issue, a blind yoga CD giveaway, Camille Caffarelli has passed in Illinois, Mystery Book Club will meet July 26th, a history of automobile radios. On Cool Blind Tech, we have Zoom for Screen Readers, a new book. NBP has published Deborah Kendrick's latest book, Navigating Healthcare When All They Can See Is That You Can't. I'm going to be reading the AFB review of that book. NBP is offering a free download through August and $6 only for the Braille copy. That's a very good deal. Today's reading of Vision News is brought to you by... From Lori Motis for the Blind Post. The July Blind Post News Submission Reminder. Hey there, Blind Post subscribers. The July edition of the Blind Post Classified News will be emailed and posted to the website on or before the 13th of July. If you have anything you'd like to include, articles, ads, or announcements, and anything else, read below on what you can submit. Please email them to foodlady@theblindpost.com on or before July 7th. All details for posting notices and what and how, plus words and costs, are below. How to post and pay for an ad or announcement. Note, you can now submit an extra notice in between the monthly news. They are emailed within 24 to 48 hours from receipt and posted to the website's homepage for up to 30 days. The word counts are the same as listed below, but do not include free notices. The 2020 word counts and costs. All current subscribers to date, 1,205. You can still post one ad, 50 words or less, for free each month. The second 50-word notice is $6. Notices that are for wanted, looking for, or giveaway section are free up to 75 words. Paying notices that are over 50 to 100 words are $6. 101 to 200 words are $11, and 201 to 300 words are $17. 301 to 400 are $23. Long-term notices for 3 months, 6 months, or longer can be negotiated for a discount. All paying submissions will appear at the beginning of their appropriate sections. New and used, wanted, to trade or give away, announcements, services and training, or business and employment opportunities. Sponsoring the Blind Post. If you would like to sponsor the Blind Post News or any future issues, please contact me. The new sponsorship cost is $40 and can be up to 800 words. They will be posted to the homepage of the website and at the beginning of the email and website news page just before the editor section. The monthly news and all notices stay up on the website for 30 days. There is room for more than one sponsor each month. Email me at thefoodlady@theblindpost.com. And I will let you know that I have received your submissions. You can either attach your notice as a Word or text document or put it in the body of the email. For payments and donations, please use foodlady@theblindpost.com with PayPal. I also accept personal checks. Please email me for my address. What can you post to the Blind Post? If you are blind or visually impaired, you can submit all types of notices from new or used items, music artists, authors, and more. Services or training, business job listings, items you are looking for to trade or to give away, and announcements that you think other readers would be interested in. Notices and announcements pertaining to the blind and low vision community from all individuals, schools, and organizations are also welcome. If you are blind or visually impaired and own a business, you can submit notices for that too, even if it doesn't necessarily pertain to the blind and low vision community. If you have any questions about your submission, email me and I will let you know if it is suitable for the Blind Post News. The editor reserves the right to decide if an announcement or notice of any kind is suitable for the Blind Post. All submissions posted are not necessarily the beliefs or opinions of the editor or the Blind Post News. Make sure your contact information is correct for each post you submit. Email all notices to foodlady@theblindpost.com. Subscriptions to The Blind Post. There's no cost to subscribe. If you do ever want to send a subscription donation, you can use foodlady@theblindpost.com with PayPal or email me for my address if you prefer sending a check. Thank you for your support. You can subscribe to The Blind Post by sending email to theblindpostplussubscribe@groups.io. To unsubscribe, send an email to theblindpostplussunsubscribe@groups.io. Signed, Lori, a.k.a. Food Lady, Lori Motis, LoriMotis, publisher and editor of The Blind Post Classified News, a great place to share and sell. www.theblindpost.com. The Lynn Hadel Memorial Yoga Giveaway. A few months ago, Lynn Hadel, LynnHedl, the president of Friends in Art, unfortunately passed away. To honor her and keep her name in our thoughts, we are beginning what could turn out to be an annual yoga program giveaway, sponsored by Marty Klein and Blind Yoga. If you are interested in learning yoga, all you need to do is send an email with your name, email address, and mailing address to marty48@hvc.rr.com. Your name will be put in a hat and 7 winners will be drawn. The names of the lucky winners will be posted in the convention newspaper. Beginning Yoga for the Blind and Visually Impaired is a 5-CD yoga program that has helped many blind and visually impaired folks on their path toward health and well-being. For more information, you can go to www.blindyoga.net. Sad news to share from Illinois. Hello, ICB and ACB friends. I'm saddened to share with you this evening that Camille Caffarelli, founder and CEO of Horizons for the Blind, passed away last night. As many of you probably know, she had been ill for a while and fought hard to beat her illness while maintaining a hand in day-to-day operations of Horizons for the Blind as long as she could. In recent months, she had to step away from Horizons as well as her ICB work in order to focus on her health. Unfortunately, she was moved into hospice care last weekend and lost her battle with cancer last night. Camille was very passionate about her Braille and used that passion to not only start Horizons for the Blind back in the 1970s, but also just a few short years ago was very instrumental in starting the Illinois Braille Revival League, an affiliate of the national ACB affiliate, BRL. I can hear her say it as I type this, that she always wanted everybody to feel important, and she always made sure to do just that for everybody she met. We in ICB have truly lost a gem and a friend in Camille Caffarelli, but her legacy and love for Braille will live on through the great work of Horizons for the Blind. If there ever was a reason at all to smile when that Braille bill comes in the mail each month, it is that we can open it up, read the Braille, and smile as we think of the tireless work by Camille and others like her who have worked so hard to keep Braille alive and under our fingertips. Signed, Rachel Schroeder, President, Illinois Council of the Blind. On Sunday, July 26, 2020, at 5 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, the Mystery Discussion Group will be discussing The Turn of the Key by Ruth Ware, W-A-R-E. You can find it on Bard by looking for DB96239. You can find it on Bookshare by looking for https://www.bookshare.org/browse/book/331555-8. All are welcome. Please use the information below to log into the meeting. We hope to see all of you then. Date, Sunday, July 26, 2020. Time, 5 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Central, 3 p.m. Mountain, 2 p.m. Pacific. Elsewhere in the world, Sunday, 2100 hours, Greenwich Mean Time. All times are daylight saving. About 10 minutes before the program, dial the Zoom numbers found on your Zoom invitation. N. Parsons, facilitator, is inviting you to a scheduled Zoom meeting. Topic, the Mystery Book Discussion Group. Time, meet Sunday, July 26, 2020 from 5 to 6 Eastern. Join from PC, Mac, Linux, iOS, or Android at https://zoom.us/j/7104-6624. iPhone telephone numbers are in the U.S. 1-408-63-80986 or 1-646-876-9923. The Zoom meeting ID is 710-434-624. International numbers available at https://zoom.us/u/CIDZ(X)KOD7. If you execute the above link from a computer with installed Zoom client software, the software should automatically launch and take you to the meeting. If you execute the above link from a smart device containing the Zoom Cloud Meetings app, the app should automatically launch and take you to the meeting. If you prefer to use your iPhone as a regular phone without the app to call into the meeting, you can double tap on one of the above two numbers to initiate the call. If you prefer calling on a regular telephone, use one of the above numbers. Signed, Robert Acosta, Chair Emeritus, www.accessibleworld.org and www.radiooutofthepast.org. Telephone 818-998-0044. Email boacosta818@gmail.com. Website www.helpinghands4theblind.net. N.K. Parsons, Portal Tutoring. Email akp@sero.email. Author of The Demis. http://www.dldbooks.com/annparsons/. Portal Tutoring website, http://www.portaltutoring.info. Skype @pewtertutor. All that is gold does not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. From coolblindtech.com, Carroll Center for the Blind publishes new guide to Zoom meetings for screen reader users. Posted June 8, 2020. Getting Started with Zoom Meetings, a Guide for JAWS, NVDA, and iPhone VoiceOver Users is the first ever step-by-step text-based guide to Zoom video communications for screen reader users. The Carroll Center for the Blind has announced that it has published a new book, Getting Started with Zoom Meetings, a Guide for JAWS, NVDA, and iPhone VoiceOver Users by Heather Thomas. The book is expected to serve as an invaluable resource for people who have vision loss, wanting to participate in and host Zoom meetings in the workplace for educational purposes and for personal use. The publication is timely, as so many people are now required to work and stay at home. We're excited to introduce this first-ever step-by-step text-based guide to Zoom video communications for screen reader users, said Thomas, who serves as the Accessibility Services Associate at the Carroll Center. With so many of us now learning, working, and connecting through remote methods, I wanted to create a resource to help during this time of social distancing as people are relying on Zoom to stay connected. The Carroll Center produced the book because its clients and staff members have been affected by nationwide stay-at-home orders and quarantines. Most remote workers at this time have shifted to telecommunication software like Zoom, Google Meet, or Skype. People who are blind or partially sighted must use special screen reading software to access digital content on computers and smartphones. With this book, they now have a guide to working effectively with Zoom meetings. The digital-only book is available to purchase for $18 on the Carroll Center store's website. About the Carroll Center for the Blind. Established in 1936, the Carroll Center for the Blind empowers those who are blind and visually impaired to achieve independence and to lead a fulfilling life. The nonprofit organization provides services for individuals of all ages, including vision rehabilitation services, vocational and transition programs, assistive technology training, educational support, services for seniors, and an optical shop. For more information, visit www.carroll.org. From AFB.org, a review of Navigating Healthcare When All They Can See Is That You Can't, by Deborah Kendrick. Review by Janet Ingber, Ingber. My first response when I learned the name of this book was, wow, what a great title. It immediately made me think about my own experiences with the medical profession. This book provides a wealth of information, including what questions to ask, how to advocate for yourself, what medical devices use accessible technology, and, of course, ways to show that just because you're blind, it does not mean you don't have a brain. Kendrick describes her own firsthand experiences, discussing how she managed different situations and providing solutions and recommendations. Kendrick writes with wit and humor throughout the book's introduction and 8 chapters. I strongly recommend starting with the intro, since it lays the groundwork for understanding her approach. Chapter 1, At the Doctor's Office. Topics in this chapter include choosing a doctor, where Kendrick gives suggestions such as searching online and asking friends. She mentions useful websites for the search. She explains the concierge medicine model, which is a model of healthcare where a patient pays up front for medical services. In the office visit section of the chapter, Kendrick gives some strategies about interacting with office and medical staff. She describes her approach, which is friendly and not confrontational. However, she reminds us if there is one single guiding principle to keep in mind throughout your journey in healthcare, it is this: you are in charge of you. Chapter 2, Outpatient Tests and Procedures. In this chapter, Kendrick has suggestions for what to do when going to a different facility for a test or procedure. One recommendation is to call the facility and get clear directions for navigating both inside and outside. She talks about knowing which tests are being ordered and describes a few common tests, including medical ultrasound and MRI. She discusses asking about the equipment being used and also discusses handling situations where you need to change into a gown or some other garment. How many of us have been asked if we need help undressing? Useful suggestions are made about what to do with your guide dog during tests. The final part of the chapter is about ambulatory surgery. Kendrick writes about the recent increase of ambulatory surgery rather than in hospital and common procedures. She makes an excellent recommendation for when you leave the facility. Chapter 3, Emergencies. Emergencies can happen anytime, anywhere. Kendrick begins by speaking about types of emergencies and whether to call 911. Go to the nearest emergency room or go to an urgent care center. If you call 911, Kendrick suggests letting the operator know that you are blind at the very beginning of the call. She gives a personal example from when she broke her femur and nobody else was home. She makes the important point to ask first responders what they're doing. Some responders may not have much interaction with someone who's blind. She offers suggestions for when an emergency room intake staff member asks, "How much can you see?" and advises preparing a brief answer in advance. Another staff situation is discussed on how to manage the range of people who come to take care of you. If they do not introduce themselves, ask who they are and what their job is. The final section of the chapter is about urgent care centers and minute clinics. She gives descriptions of what these facilities can treat and the types of medical professionals staffing these clinics. At the end of the chapter, we are reminded to have contact information on hand prior to needing it, on what services are available where. Chapter 4, Hospital Stays. This chapter begins with questions you might want to ask when admitted to the hospital. She discusses an unplanned hospital stay, such as being admitted from the emergency room. She covers making sure you know your location, including floor and room, and asking someone to orient you to your surroundings. Kendrick reminds us to have conversations with hospital staff and that hospital staff may not have any experience with someone who's blind. Even if someone does have experience with patients with vision loss, you should let them know your specific needs. Suggestions include asking staff to knock before entering and identifying themselves when they enter your room. Kendrick points out that each blind person is unique, just as every other patient is unique. She adds, the extra hurdle for us, regrettably, is the need to move past the misconceptions that are all too often held about our capabilities. Kendrick discusses advocating for yourself and having an advocate with you whenever possible. She talks about a sign that a hospital member posted over her bed. You will have to read the book to find out what that sign said. Here's a hint. It was incredibly inappropriate. Kendrick provides suggestions for what to do prior to being admitted for a planned hospital stay or a planned time at a rehabilitation facility. These recommendations are very useful and can help make your stay less stressful. Chapter 5, For Blind Parents and Grandparents. This chapter focuses on when your child or grandchild has a medical emergency. As she does throughout the book, Kendrick gives excellent anecdotes from her own life. For example, she talks about the time her daughter was in the emergency room. She advises, stay with the patient every step of the way until you're given a scientific reason not to. She also discusses the importance of choosing a good pediatrician and things to do if your child or grandchild is admitted to the hospital. She reminds us that although the chapter is about children, these same principles apply when you are a caregiver in any relationship. Chapter 6, Managing Medications. This chapter contains information about labeling and dosing medications. Kendrick provides many options, such as using Braille labels and Envision America Script Talk. She also provides information about measuring correct amounts of liquid medication. Chapter 7, Using Technology to Narrow the Gap. Kendrick discusses various forms of technology, including websites and apps. For example, WebMD is a website and app that provides a tremendous amount of information. She discusses apps that let you read text and learn what is near you as well. In addition, Kendrick discusses apps and devices for monitoring health at home and provides product information for the devices. Chapter 8, The Art of Knowing When. In this chapter, Kendrick provides some final tips and reminders. She discusses two additional life experiences, one where she was not allowed to do something because staff mistakenly thought she might get hurt because of her blindness, and the other where staff instructions were correct and unrelated to vision. Conclusion. This is an excellent book, whether you have been blind or visually impaired for your whole life or are new to vision loss. Kendrick provides useful information in every chapter, sharing anecdotes and recommendations. Although there's a lot of material, she presents it in a conversational style, making it easy to read. Book information. Navigating Healthcare When All They Can See Is That You Can't by Deborah Kendrick is published in Braille, BRF, Daisy Text, and Word by National Braille Press. The book is available in hard copy Braille, Daisy, eBraille, and Microsoft Word formats for $12. To have a digital copy mailed to you on a USB drive, add $250. This article is made possible in part by generous funding from the James H. and Alice Tubert Charitable Trust, Huntington, West Virginia. The National Braille Press website is providing free downloads of the book through the end of August and only $6 for Braille copies. Here is a brief history of the car radio. Seems like cars have always had radios, but they didn't. Here's the story. One evening in 1929, two young men named William Lear and Elmer Wavering drove their girlfriends to a lookout point high above the Mississippi River town of Quincy, Illinois, to watch the sunset. It was a romantic night, to be sure, but one of the women observed that it would be even nicer if they could listen to music in the car. Lear and Wavering liked the idea. Both men had tinkered with radios. Lear served as a radio operator in the U.S. Navy during World War I, and it wasn't long before they were taking apart a home radio and trying to get it to work in a car. But it wasn't easy. Automobiles have ignition switches, generators, spark plugs, and other electrical equipment that generate noisy static interference, making it nearly impossible to listen to the radio when the engine was running. One by one, Lear and Wavering identified and eliminated each source of electrical interference. When they finally got their radio to work, they took it to a radio convention in Chicago. There, they met Paul Galvin, owner of Galvin Manufacturing Corporation. He made a product called a battery eliminator, a device that allowed battery-powered radios to run on household AC current. But as more homes were wired for electricity, more radio manufacturers made AC-powered radios. Galvin needed a new product to manufacture. When he met Lear and Wavering at the radio convention, he found it. He believed that mass-produced, affordable car radios had the potential to become a huge business. Lear and Wavering set up shop in Galvin's factory, and when they perfected their first radio, they installed it in his Studebaker. Then Galvin went to a local banker to apply for a loan. Thinking it might sweeten the deal, he had his men install a radio in the banker's Packard. Good idea, but it didn't work. Half an hour after the installation, the banker's Packard caught on fire. They didn't get the loan. Galvin didn't give up. He drove his Studebaker nearly 800 miles to Atlantic City to show off the radio at the 1930 Radio Manufacturers Association convention. Too broke to afford a booth, he parked the car outside the convention hall and cranked up the radio so that passing conventioners could hear it. That idea worked. He got enough orders to put the radio into production. What's in a name? That first production model was called the 5T71. Galvin decided he needed to come up with something catchier. In those days, many companies in the phonograph and radio businesses used the suffix "-ola," for their names. Radio La Columbiola and Victrola were three of the biggest. Galvin decided to do the same thing, and since his radio was intended for use in a motor vehicle, he decided to call it the Motorola. But even with the name change, the radio still had problems. When Motorola went on sale in 1930, it cost about $110 uninstalled. At a time when you could buy a brand new car for $650, and the country was sliding into the Great Depression. By that measure, a radio for a new car would cost about $3,000 today. In 1930, it took two men several days to put in a car radio. The dashboard had to be taken apart so that the receiver and a single speaker could be installed, and the ceiling had to be cut open to install the antenna. These early radios ran on their own batteries, not on the car battery, so holes had to be cut into the floorboard to accommodate them. The installation manual had 8 complete diagrams and 28 pages of instructions. Selling complicated car radios that cost 20% of the price of a brand new car wouldn't have been easy in the best of times, let alone during the Great Depression. Galvin lost money in 1930 and struggled for a couple of years after that. But things picked up in 1933 when Ford began offering Motorolas pre-installed at the factory. In 1934, they got another boost when Galvin struck a deal with B.F. Goodrich Tire Company to sell and install them in its chain of tire stores. By then, the price of the radio, with installation included, had dropped to $55. The Motorola car radio was off and running. The name of the company would be officially changed from Galvin Manufacturing to Motorola in 1947. In the meantime, Galvin continued to develop new uses for car radios. In 1936, the same year that it introduced push-button tuning, it also introduced the Motorola Police Cruiser, a standard car radio that was factory preset to a single frequency to pick up police broadcasts. In 1940, he developed the first handheld two-way radio, the Handy Talkie, for the U.S. Army. A lot of the communications technologies that we take for granted today were born in Motorola labs in the years that followed World War II. In 1947, they came out with the first television for under $200. In 1956, the company introduced the world's first pager. In 1969 came the radio and television equipment that was used to televise Neil Armstrong's first steps on the moon. In 1973, it invented the world's first handheld cellular phone. Today, Motorola is one of the largest cell phone manufacturers in the world, and it all started with the car radio. Whatever happened to the two men who installed the first radio in Paul Galvin's car? Elmer Wavering and William Lear ended up taking very different paths in life. Wavering stayed with Motorola. In the 1950s, he helped change the automobile experience again when he developed the first automotive alternator, replacing inefficient and unreliable generators. The invention led to such luxuries as power windows, power seats, and eventually air conditioning. Lear also continued inventing. He holds more than 150 patents. Remember 8-track tape players? Lear invented that. But what he's really famous for are his contributions to the field of aviation. Have you ever heard of a Learjet? Not bad for a guy who dropped out of school after 8th grade. We've run out of time for today's episode of Vision News. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Doris Hyde, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Vision News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening.